All right, let's get started. We've got a tight schedule today.
Tight schedule.
All right, good afternoon, everyone. This is Commissioner Brian Kalk, meeting the 12th floor of the Capitol today. It's Wednesday, June 19th, approximately 1:30 p.m. We're meeting for a informal dealing with Nexus Communication Inc.'s request to be designated with eligible telecommunication carrier, case number PU 13-98. We'll eventually go around and take who's all here. I don't have any opening comments, but I would offer it up to Commissioner Crispin and then Commissioner Fedorchuk, and then we'll go around the room.
Well, just to acknowledge, you know, I think probably everyone in the room knows I have some concerns with these Lifeline-only ETCs, so I'm anxious to hear the proposal, and I've read through it and learn a little more about their proposal, and hopefully sometime soon we can start reaching some resolution on how we want to handle these.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Fedorchuk.
Yes, good afternoon. I, too, have some concerns. I've appreciated all of Commissioner Crispin's work on this, digging in, and I think we're making progress on some measures that we can take that will be reasonable for the companies and also give us some assurance that we have some mechanisms in place to minimize some of the potential problems that have been experienced elsewhere. So looking forward to this discussion today.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner. Let's go ahead and start with Mr. Hogue, representing the company. If you could get your name for the record and those that are joining us by the phone.
Yes. Thank you, President Kalk. My name is David Hogue, and I am an attorney with Pringle and Herrickstead Law Firm in Minot, North Dakota. I do appear on behalf of Nexus Communications, Inc. On the telephone are three individuals. First of all, the president, Mr. Stephen Fenker. He will be going through the application and give you some background on Nexus. And then two of Nexus's attorneys are also on the phone. Danielle Frappier and Mr. Alan Galloway are both on the phone.
Okay, thank you very much. And then joining us from staff, Pat, you guys could acknowledge yourself.
Sure. Patrick Fawn, Commission staff.
Sarah Cardwell, Commission staff.
All right, thank you. And we also have Ryan and Austin, our full-time attorney and one our legal intern, just listening in. So before I turn it over to Mr. Hogue, just to give a little more amplification of what Commissioner Crispin and Commissioner Fedorchuk were talking about, there are several ETCs in front of this commission right now. And in another case dealing with Telrite's request, we're working on basically a certification document that the companies agreed to a whole bunch of things, basically dealing with consumer protection. And that case is kind of hung up right now until we finalize this document. And so I think what I'm envisioning, I'm hearing my colleagues say, is that whatever comes out of that case certification is something that we'll more than likely would ask the company to certify in this case. I think that's kind of where we're headed to, but that's a little background behind it. And I'm sure that if you talk with Patrick or Sarah afterwards, you could certainly get a look at the document. Maybe some of the questions that we might ask today may pertain to that certification as well. But with that, I'd turn it over to you, Mr. Hogan, and let you proceed.
Well, Commissioner Kalk, that's a good point. We have listened to the working session that you had with regard to Telrite's application, so we're familiar with your concerns in that case. I think that was early May, a working session. So we've reviewed the Telrite application and your concerns. We've also reviewed the budget application, which is a similar limited ETC application. So I think we're prepared today to talk about those concerns. And with that, I'll just turn it over to Mr. Fenker, and he can go through Nexus's application.
Okay, thank you. All right, Stephen, I think it's your nickel.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you for this opportunity. I wanted to just give everyone sort of a background on Nexus. We've been in the business for over 12 years. Unlike a lot of the wireless ETC applicants, we didn't start out providing Lifeline products via wireless mode. We basically started back in 2000 providing local exchange service. So we started out as a CLEC. Basically competing with AT&T and Verizon, those major wireline incumbents. And it wasn't until around 2006 that because our customer demographic has always included the mid to low income demographic, we decided to be one of the first competitive CLECs to basically file for ETC status, which we did back in 2006. So we provided Lifeline supported services from approximately 2006 until 2008, until, in essence, the customer demand for wireless service basically just exploded at that point. And based on strictly nothing more than customer demand, our business model basically migrated towards a wireless Lifeline offering, essentially following TracFone's model, because TracFone was really truly one of the first competitive wireless providers to provide Lifeline, or to at least take on the Lifeline market as something that, instead of being an obligation on the ILEC, is basically taken on by a company that thinks that they can provide a service that's never really been provided before effectively. We followed a lot of what they had been able to do in terms of sort of breaking the glass ceiling and allowing wireless Lifeline to exist as a business model. We started out in the state of Michigan. We're based here in Columbus, Ohio, but we started out in Michigan, which was really our first state for wireline ETC status. And in essence, over the next several years, just sort of migrated across the United States, providing the service. We were and still are the third largest wireless Lifeline provider. The two companies that are really above us are really multinational, publicly traded companies. We're sort of a small, privately held company based here in Columbus, Ohio, with approximately 100 employees. Our business model has changed over the last several years. We've migrated a business model that's based upon investment in brick-and-mortar retail. We feel that that's the only real way to do the service justice in terms of being able to effectively sign up a potential Lifeline subscriber, verify their eligibility, and provide them a service that makes sense both to them and to us in terms of a successful product. In my personal opinion, I think there's a lot of entities that are in this space that are really going after the basic Lifeline free phone customer. That's not at all what we're all about. We're basically a company that wants to use the Lifeline program for what we think it was intended for, which is basically a hand up, not a handout, and a process that allows economically challenged families the ability to basically reestablish connectivity to the telecommunications network. The goal with our brick-and-mortar rollout is that we want to be able to provide the ability for Lifeline subscribers that have basically, you know, 250-minute or 125-minute free plan, the ability to upgrade that handset into something that's data-capable and something that they're actually paying for. So it's almost, in a crude analogy, it's almost a welfare-to-work type of business model. We've been very successful with it, and we plan on actually doing that also in North Dakota as well. In fact, you know, we're investing in hiring employees based in North Dakota. We're working with the Local Economic Development Corporation, the EDC, in terms of hiring some folks. We have some former ComNet cellular folks that are coming on board as well. So this is really part of our long-term strategy. And the reason I go into this level of detail is I wanted to just give you a little bit of background on us and separate Nexus from perhaps the majority of the other wireless Lifeline providers. Does that give you a fairly good idea of what we're trying to do?
Steve, yeah, Brian here. We'll probably each go down the line for some questions. Just a couple of clarifications. So you're anticipating staff to be based in North Dakota?
Well, what we're actually doing is we've rolled out a retail brick-and-mortar business model. We're doing it in all the states that we're approved in. Basically, in essence, we're starting out by establishing in every major city, at least one brick-and-mortar retail location that's actually established by Nexus. We then, at that point, obviously hire local people in terms of we want them to be good stewards of the program. They're going to be trained in terms of what the Lifeline requirements are. they're going to actually be Nexus employees as opposed to, say, you know, third-party agents that don't really have any direct relationship with the company, as you've seen probably in some of these negative news articles where there's this tent marketing and these turning on cell phones out of trunks of vehicles. We're completely opposed to that. We have filed comments at the FCC supporting the elimination of the tent and the mobile enrollment vehicles. We're actually working with Trackbone on that issue at the FCC. Our entire business model at this point is one where we're trying to migrate 100% to a brick-and-mortar type of offering. Once we are established in a marketplace, we would like to then at that point work with some of the established retailers that are in those markets, the ones that have been there for a long time, the ones that have wireless experience. One of the biggest problems that we've seen over the years is the fact that when the customer or the subscriber is provided a handset through the mail, if there's a problem with that handset, it's very, very difficult for the subscriber to get their problem solved. Whereas if Lifeline through Nexus is distributed through a brick-and-mortar type of relationship with the customer, they've always got a fixed location to go back in and replace that handset if there's a problem, reprogram the handset if there's a programming issue, obtain other features for that handset, upgrade the handset. It's a way of solving what we think has been one of the major shortcomings of the program, is that it's all been based on bottom-of-the-line, non-data-capable handsets. And we all know that the handset business and the tablet market and the laptop type of technology is sort of morphing into one object, and that's going to be a data device. And we believe that's where the future is.
Okay, thanks, Steve. I'm a pretty basic guy. I mean, so how many sites are you looking at? I mean, so the answer I think I heard was yes. And then you're thinking about four or five of these in the state, or just to give a range of what you're thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at Fargo, Bismarck, perhaps Minot, Jamestown, those type of locations to establish a retail presence.
Okay.
Obviously, we're very, very early in on the process, but that's what we're looking at.
Fair enough. And then just a couple more for me, and I'll turn over to my colleagues. So you have an FCC compliance plan that has, I assume, already been approved?
Yes, that is true. It was approved on December 26th of 2012.
Okay, and then I guess really for me that was all that I really had, so I'll turn it over to Commissioner Crispin and Commissioner Fedorchak if she has any questions, and then maybe staff.
How many states are you licensed in right now, or that you have ETC status?
I couldn't give you the exact number. I can give you an estimate. I believe we're in 24 states as an ETC, which would be a wireline ETC, and I believe we're in about 22 states from a wireless ETC perspective. But I can get you those exact numbers.
Well, if it's close, that's fine. So quite a few. The recertification reports, or what's the process of recertifying with FCC and USAC?
What is Nexus's procedures in re-enrolling the customer on an annual requirement? Is that what you mean?
Well, whatever permit you need from the FCC or USAC, is that something you get recertified annually, or is the only thing that you need is ETC status from each of the states, or what do you need from them?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, there is a requirement to get the compliance plan approved. At that point, I don't believe there is an annual re-verification requirement at the FCC. There have been some states, if I remember correctly, that in essence establish an order that included I don't know what they would call it, maybe a provisional 12-month ETC certificate. But whatever states that's occurred in, which I think is maybe only maybe one or two states, they've renewed those for us on every occasion, so there's never been any issues with that.
if would Nexus be willing to have your customers sign off on a North Dakota form that would allow us and the Human Services Department to communicate their information back and forth, and on some, you know, whether it's monthly or quarterly or some kind of a schedule, supply us the customer list so that we would be able to verify their qualifications.
Oh yes, absolutely. Our initial Lifeline certification form grants Nexus and any third-party database that Nexus needs access to, or any state or federal authority that needs access to verify eligibility. They already provide us that right, and they've given us that ability to do that in our existing form, and we would certainly be glad to turn anything over to you that you would need to verify eligibility, either on a rolling basis or on an annual basis or however you'd like to do it. That's, of course, something we'd be glad to do.
I'd like to see a blank copy of that form, and then we could discuss with our human services whether they're comfortable with it and that gives them what they need, or whether they need something more specific.
If I could interject, this is Danielle. I just wanted to mention that attached to Nexus's application is the compliance plan that we submitted to the FCC. And at the back of that compliance plan, you'll see blank Lifeline application forms for Nexus. And so the language we thought would be sufficient, but obviously are open to discussing, is the second to last sort of checkbox there. So, you have a copy of it included with Nexus's application. Take a look, or have DHS take a look and let us know if you think something else is needed. But, I guess ideally, we would like to have any language we need for that authorization right there on the Lifeline application form, so that's all in one piece of paper. But we can discuss that further.
Okay, I see that form in my packet of information now.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now I'm shuffling back to where I was before. So just give me a moment, please. If you were approved the status, how long would it be until you'd be up and running, and what advertising methods do you use in states with rural demographics like ours?
Yeah, that's a great question. Every market obviously is different in terms of what outreach tool is effective. We have found in the more rural markets, direct mail marketing has worked more effectively than say network television or radio advertising. What we like to do is that once we are established there with a brick and mortar presence, we do quite a bit of data mining in terms of maximizing the amount of potential eligible subscribers that are surrounding those locations, and we will use whatever combination of either print media or radio media, whatever works for us most effectively, to let those potential eligible Lifeline subscribers know about the ability of the service being available to them. The subscriber can always go to our website and enroll online and have the phone shipped to them. Again, that's a business model that we've really been trying to get away from for the last 12 months. We still do it. There's still a demand for it. It's just from our perspective, that business model it leaves the subscriber somewhat not as satisfied in terms of getting the equipment that they want, getting the answers that they need to programming the phone, perhaps, or setting up their voicemail account. It's much easier to do that in person and making sure that they are happy with the phone, that the phone works the way they want it. There's data available on it, so they know how to use the data. It's just us, just really the future of the program.
Is this ETC status like the final barrier to starting things up in North Dakota, or are there other types of permits or approvals or something that you need?
I believe that that's the final step for us. We have filed for CMRS authority. Other than that, if there's any sort of local licensing requirements from the stores, obviously we would take care of that as well. But from our perspective, that's really the last requirement in terms of what we need to be able to provide the service.
And did you tell us a time frame of how long you thought it would be until you'd be up and running once you had ETC status?
I mean, I can tell you on average it would probably take maybe 30 days. On the outside, 60 days, something like that.
Very good. I have nothing more right now.
All right, thank you. Commissioner Fedorchuk.
Good afternoon. Couple questions here. What percent, Steve, you mentioned that your business model has changed over the years. What percent of your business is directed on this Lifeline, wireless Lifeline ETC now, or providing wireless Lifeline services?
I mean, that's a great question. I mean, in 2008, obviously, we were 100% on the local exchange service. We obviously, at that point, had very few wireless subscribers. Now, I would say it's probably completely flip-flopped. I would probably say, and this is just an estimate, I could get you the actual numbers. I would say probably less than 5% are still using wireline as compared to wireless. It's just a means of communicating that is just not, at least from where we're from our perspective, is just not desirable. The fact that wireless is portable is really the biggest driver, I think, from the subscribers side of things. And obviously, that demand is now pushing into the broadband area and the data area. And from my perspective, I've been in this business a long time. The time frames from technology changing, you know, used to be 5 or 8 years, are now shrinking, and it's a matter of 1 or 2 or 3 years that technology is changing. And I've already seen it changing in the wireless space, where, as I mentioned earlier, from our perspective, you know, the whole concept of cell phones versus tablets versus laptops are morphing now into sort of one technology, and I would garner to believe that in a very short period of time, that's where everything is going to. So that's why we believe that to be able to distribute broadband capable devices, laptops, tablets, data devices, without a brick and mortar presence in any particular Lifeline market, we just don't believe that there's any real way to successfully provide that service.
So what percent is the Lifeline of your focus?
Again, I couldn't be able to give you the exact specifics. We do have a non-Lifeline customer base, both on the wireline and the wireless side. Obviously, that's a much smaller percentage than the Lifeline space, only because this has really been the demographic that we have been able to serve effectively over the last 12 years. So it's... really, to answer your question, it's an overwhelming majority would be Lifeline.
Okay. And then you mentioned that you're not looking for the typical Lifeline customer where they're just kind of able to get the free phone and that's it. You're looking for someone who can qualify but yet might have a few resources to upgrade and purchase additional services or minutes. Is that a correct understanding?
It is. I mean, I would modify it slightly by saying that we believe that every potential Lifeline subscriber has the ability to sort of use the service to better themselves. And we believe that if we can migrate someone from a non-paying plan to a paying plan, we think it's a positive for everyone. I can tell you on a daily basis we provide, you know, examples for customers that are obtaining loans. I know this sounds kind of crazy, but it is the truth. I mean, if a low-income person is trying to establish just essential basic credit, any kind of proof of payment on any kind of recurring basis is helps them substantially. So we get this request on a daily basis to be able to provide someone that's asking for it a sort of history of their account so that they can, you know, show that they've made payments, they bought additional airtime, or they've made some sort of recurring payments towards the service. Once we do that, it helps them immeasurably. And so from our perspective, if we can migrate, you know, just a Lifeline subscriber that's just using the phone as just an emergency phone, and to using that phone literally as their primary means of communicating, it helps for employment purposes. It helps for the ability to, you know, basically start using data in terms of being able to get an initial sense as to how broadband works or internet connectivity. That's really our focus.
Okay. And how many estimated, this is, you're in 18 states, according to your application for Lifeline. You chose North Dakota. I'm curious why you picked us next and how many customers you estimate to be here available in the kind of target you're looking for.
Yeah, that's a really great question. I don't know specifically. I would say we get you the data in terms of what we believe the total potential customer subscriber base might be. But as I mentioned, I mean, we look upon states like North Dakota as needing the services just as much as New York City or Chicago, Illinois. And as I mentioned, we have some connectivity and some connections to some former ComNet folks that know the market very well. And they're telling us that it's a market that, even though it's well taken care of in terms of, you know, the ILAC and some of the world, there's still a Lifeline subscriber base that needs services there, and we believe that we can deliver those services effectively.
Okay. I did not see in the application a map or a listing of the kind of specific communities or areas you intend to be in. Is there one? I'm sorry, I didn't. Is it in
a, this is Alan Galloway. There is one included in the application, Commissioner. A list of wire centers identifying.
Oh, there it is. I'm sorry. Yep. Okay.
Talks to you in the application by Quest Corporation.
Yep, right here. All righty. Thank you. Then, if I could ask a few questions about the application process and how you screen people. I did see in your FCC compliance plan on page 9 and 10 a description of that, but I'm wondering if someone can just sort of walk through how you, you know, when a customer comes in, what do they do, what do you ask for, what do you verify, how do you make sure that there isn't two customers in one, you know, location that is receiving the service under the Lifeline program.
Did we lose the feed? Still there? She didn't want that question. Must have dropped a feed.
Well, did we call them or did they call us?
They called us.
They'll probably call back. They're probably answering right now. They're talking. Don't realize we can't hear.
Yeah, I can.
They all called in from different places, though, didn't they?
Redialing, yeah.
So it must be our feed, our connection that dropped.
I can try to dial ours again.
What happened there, Scotty? All three dropped at the same time, so it's like it's ours probably.
Someone hit an one of those transitions.
I don't know. Shouldn't need the one. Did it work last time or not?
Are they all in one location?
No, they're
like, oh, no?
They should be in different locations. I think there's one in D.C. and one in Ohio.
Ohio. Yeah. Oh. All time zones are covered.
Davis?
Yeah.
They,
they have...
Welcome. You have reached the audio conferencing system. After the tone, enter your conference.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That was on the app. Well.
After the tone, please state your name, followed by the pound key. Someone has entered the conference.
This is Brian here again. Are you? Who we got back out there now?
I believe that we're all here. This is Alan Galloway of Davis Rich Main for Nexus, and I believe Mr. Finker and Ms. Rapier are on the line as well.
Okay, perfect. I'll let Commissioner Fedorchuk restate her question. We lost you somewhere. We dropped off. I'm not sure. But either way, we're back now communicating.
Okay. So if you heard the whole question, my apologies for repeating it, but we didn't hear any of your answers, so I'll have to start over anyway. I'd like somebody to walk through the process of how you review the customers for eligibility, assuming like a new customer just walks in. Walk us through the steps of what you do, what you ask them, what they have to show in terms of certification or documentation, how you verify that, and how you assure that there isn't more than one customer from the same family or same location applying for or receiving Lifeline services.
Sure, absolutely. Every person that is dealing with the subscriber directly from Nexus's perspective is fully trained in terms of what the requirements are, in terms of being able to delineate, some of the qualifiers are fairly easy to determine. For example, you know, the SNAP program, food stamp benefits, there's not a lot of gray area there. Whereas if you look at some of the Medicaid requirements, it gets much more complicated. And, for example, since the state or some states have basically contracted with third parties, you know, sometimes insurance companies to provide both Medicare and Medicaid benefits, it takes quite a bit of training to get someone to understand the delineation between Medicare and Medicaid, for example. Section 8 LTIP, that's fairly straightforward. But in essence, when a potential Lifeline subscriber contacts Nexus, either directly through a brick-and-mortar retailer or through through the website, the very first step is to explain, obviously, the program, explain the optional airtime packages that are available, explain how the program works in terms of the handsets. But once the qualification stage of the initial merge with a potential Lifeline subscriber turns to verification of eligibility, we take that very, very seriously, and we look at the documentation that's provided. And we make sure that what is provided matches who the subscriber is. We require a photo ID. And obviously the threshold test for us is once that initial information is obtained, we data dip that into our existing database to make sure that that subscriber isn't active with us already, say, either on a landline side from a Lifeline perspective or the wireless side. And if we find out that there's an issue, we let that subscriber know why they were denied for Lifeline. We work with the subscriber that if they, you know, provide some information that doesn't quite get them over the goal line in terms of verifying the eligibility, we will work with the subscriber to obtain the required documents to establish qualifications for Lifeline. Again, it's something that we take very, very seriously. We know that the obligation that was imposed on us by the order. We think we've developed systems that made that process work very efficiently and very effectively.
Stephen, how has this changed then? Because there has been so much fraud in this program. How have the requirements or how has that process changed over the years to eliminate the fraud, or where did it occur in the past? I'm assuming that was a process that was followed all along.
Well, I mean, you had originally a process where all that was required was a signed self-certification or a penalty of perjury that they had obtained benefits. By requiring the additional information, it really removes any gray area in terms of whether that customer is qualified or not. Obviously, we've said that we really believe the national database is the only really preferred way of ensuring that both the subscriber doesn't already have it with another potential lifeline provider and also that they're qualified. That's certainly something that we've been advocating for and have been pushing for quite some time. Hopefully, by December of this year, when the FCC says that the national database will be up and running, that should solve the problem. Because, you know, from my personal perspective, it's not just a matter of verifying eligibility. It's a matter of ensuring that any potential lifeline subscriber doesn't already have service with another provider. And until the FCC establishes a national database, there's really no way to verify. There's nothing we can do as a carrier to provide that filter. At this point, we're still relying on self-certification under penalty of perjury that subscriber does not already have lifeline service with someone else. I think the FCC has done a fantastic job with the IDD process. They've done a lot of work in terms of obtaining the customer subscriber bases of all the EPCs and comparing them. You know, that's obviously been very effective. Unfortunately, I think it's much more work for them. I'd rather see the national database be put in place so that it's something that happens initially rather than something that happens down the road.
Mm-hmm. If I could just interject, I would add that obviously we now get proof of eligibility, which was not required prior to the reform order. So that, I think, has done a lot to help bring reform to the program. Nexus was one of the founding industry participants to create the IDD process that Steve mentioned. And if you're not familiar with that, that is the process where prior to the anti-duplication database coming online, there's this interim process where carriers give subscriber lists to USAC, and USAC compares them, finds the dupes, and then those folks get de-enrolled. That got launched with a group of ETCs, which included Nexus, who paid a third-party contractor to assist in that process and obviously paid my fees to participate in the group where we worked intensively over the course of a few months to get that process off the ground. And one of the things that I would mention is that we now have a rule where if someone is on a plan that requires no out-of-pocket payment, we have to monitor usage and de-enroll the person if they haven't used the service in the last 60 days. Nexus actually adopted that from the beginning of its wireless operation, so it was doing that years before that ever became a rule. And so, you know, it's always sought to be proactive in trying to get rid of any waste, fraud, or abuse. You know, it is also now advocating for getting rid of Lifeline enrollments in tents and street corner, you know, facilities or in vehicles. So it's doing everything that we can, you know, but obviously the database, once that comes online, that's really the permanent solution, and we've been pushing for that at the FCC. I would also mention that Nexus has suggested that ETCs be required to post $250,000 bond with the FCC so that there's money on hand if any of them are found to have gotten lifeline funding that they shouldn't have or are otherwise subject to any fines. So those are just some key examples of things that Nexus has done to really try to, you know, bring this program, you know, further reform the program.
Mm-hmm. And was that Danielle who was just speaking?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you, Danielle. Yes. What was the name of that program you cited that you helped create, the interim program between the now and the database?
Sure. And I'd be happy to send you more information about it, but it's the interim duplicate resolution process, a lot of people refer to it as IDV. That's the IDV stands for in-depth data validation, which really is just a letter from USAC saying, "Hey, give me your subscriber list." The process specifically focused on comparing these lists and getting rid of duplicates is the interim duplicate resolution process. There was an order that came out in, I think, June 2011 that established it. And I think they've gone through 15 to 20 states now and achieved really a lot of big savings by, you know, clearing out much of the duplicate funding.
Okay. Are you confident that that database will be ready to go in December?
It should be. And in fact, I am right now missing the webinar that USAC is putting on where we're supposed to be getting more information about timing and process of rolling that out. I've got an associate listening to it. So I'm hoping that we're going to get more details about the timing today. But I can assure you they are getting, they meaning the SEC, is getting a lot of pressure from industry, from Congress, from absolutely everybody to get that thing up and running.
Mm-hmm. And then with that piece in place, do you think that there's enough being done, there are enough new protocols in place to kind of address this fraud and abuse issue?
That database to be up by the end of the year is will eliminate and prevent duplicates, which is one of the biggest issues. Another proposal that Nexus would really like to see, we've supported and made multiple filings before the FCC, is to allow ETCs to keep copies of the proof of eligibility. So I think that once you have that in place, coupled with the anti-dupe database, that's really going to fully address everything. There is another database planned which would allow us to, check for eligibility directly in databases of folks getting food stamps or other benefits. It's going to take longer for them to get that online. So in the interim, we think that the easy solution is just let us keep copies of the proof. Getting rid of tents and marketing out of vehicles, we think would go a long ways to stamp out whatever waste, fraud, or abuse isn't addressed by the anti-dupe database.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That concludes my questions for now.
Thank you, Julie. We'll go back around here, but for Pat or Sarah, do you have any questions that you'd like to ask?
Yes, this is Sarah. I have a few questions. And in regards to the fact that your company has said they're going to build brick-and-mortar operations, I didn't notice that in the application. Was I missing something? Is that a change or just something that wasn't fully expressed?
I basically would address that by saying this is really something that we don't necessarily want to telegraph to competitors. A lot of the companies, as I mentioned earlier, are still sort of doing the old business model because they came into the space much later than we did, maybe 3 or 4 years after we have. We understand where we think the market's going, and it is a very competitive space, as you're aware of the fact that there's approximately 38 wireless ETCs that are pending right now in front of the FCC just for the 10-state federal FCC state. So it's a very, very competitive market, which is good. That's what the FCC and Congress intended. But from my perspective, I don't like to provide too much details in the applications because it's a lot easier for competitors to sort of purview file documents than it is to take the time, for example, to obtain the transcript from the hearing today to find out this information. It's not a secret. It's something that's known to the FCC. It's something that we're advocating for. Right now, the FCC, or TracOne has filed with the FCC a petition to, quote, removed the ability to do any kind of in-person enrollment. We agree with Trackbone. We work with Trackbone on getting rid of the tent marketing and the trunks of cars marketing. We obviously feel that eliminating anything but sending the phone through the mail is not the way to go here. We believe the only truly effective way to maintain control of the program is the brick-and-mortar business model, and that's something that we're aggressively pursuing.
Okay, thank you. You probably also heard about the proceedings in Georgia. I don't know if you're involved in those, where there's been some discussion that if the customer actually has some skin in the game, some kind of charge, that'll help eliminate the potential for waste, fraud, and abuse. So in looking at your FCC filing, I noticed you have these three plans in California where there is an out-of-pocket charge with each of those plans. And just wondering what your feeling is on, say, offering those plans versus the ones that you've been offering in the majority of your states.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. California was a state that did require at one point a minimum monthly fee. It was $2.50. They have, as of probably 3 months ago, eliminated that requirement. And we believe that Georgia's proposition to basically incur a $5 minimum fee, we think that's bad public policy. And the reason being, there are a certain percentage of Lifeline subscribers, the most neediest members of society, that simply just don't have the funds, the disposable income. And I know that, you know, from most persons' perspective, that sounds pretty crazy, but I've experienced this demographic for a long time. I've gone out in the field. I've experienced poverty. I know exactly what it's all about. And the requirement to mandate something that's been provided to somebody for several years now at no cost, and to basically make them pay a recurring charge for something that they're not used to doing, is going to be a jolt to the system, and I think it's going to punish the people who need it the most. Certainly, there's going to be subscribers that, you know, if a minimum fee is required everywhere and across the board and it's a uniform, you know, we're trying to basically transition the concept of free into a subsidized program the way it was originally intended. But again, that's not for everyone. And when you look at the people who are using this phone the most and perhaps the most effective use of the phone are the people that are affected the most by poverty. And if you mandatorily impose this charge, we think there's going to be a very high percentage of Lifeline subscribers that will just fall off the network and will not be participating, at least through telecommunications anymore.
If I could just add a couple of points to that. One, the Georgia Commission is actually, looks like they're probably backing away from that proposal. They are hopefully getting a database together that would allow the ETC to determine eligibility by hooking into the DHS database. And so things are very fluid there, but what may end up happening is that you would only have to charge the $5 if you don't dip into the database. Well, every ETC I know is going to dip into the database to, you know, definitively determine eligibility. And I would also add that in Oklahoma, the ETCs, for sort of historic reasons there, all charge some sort of out-of-pocket fee. And in terms of accusations of waste, fraud, and abuse, Oklahoma is pretty much ground zero for that. So I fail to see how that's helped them at all. I think if we're concerned about duplicate support and we're concerned about whether or not someone is actually eligible, then we should work on determining eligibility and eliminating duplication through these databases. I think the minimum fee charge sort of sounds, it's sort of attractive at first blush, but if you look at it, it really doesn't help anyone.
Okay, thank you. Do you know how many minutes the average person uses each month on a cell phone?
To answer that question, I don't know specifically, but when I'm looking at, for example, data from our existing Lifeline subscribers, I can tell you this, that an overwhelming majority of them use an overwhelming majority of the minutes that are provided every month. So there's, in essence, to give you kind of a view from above, an eagle-eye view of the whole usage pattern of most Lifeline, wireless Lifeline subscribers, in my opinion, you're talking about a scenario where most of the minutes are utilized and very few additional airtime purchases are made. So the 250 minutes is something that must be working effectively for the Lifeline subscriber, meaning it's, if they know how to budget the minutes and they know how to use the phone effectively, it's an amount of minutes that does make sense for them.
So are you saying then you don't get as many subscribers for the 68 and 125-minute plans?
Yes, that's correct. An overwhelming majority actually go for the 250-minute plan.
So is there a reason then to even offer the other two plans?
It's basically a situation where for an existing, maybe potentially smaller base of potential Lifeline applicants, the ability for those minutes to roll over makes those packages more attractive. If they're a Lifeline subscriber that potentially uses for text messaging, then the 250-minute plan customer, those packages make more sense. There are reasons for why some potential subscribers stay on those packages. Obviously, you know, we give every potential Lifeline applicant the ability to choose. We explain the different plans. And as I mentioned earlier, an overwhelming majority of our subscribers are on the 250-minute plan.
Okay. I was just curious if there was a reason for having three plans and if, you know, you could make it less confusing by just offering one. But I know that's what they're doing in Colorado. They're basically saying 250 minutes, that's the only plan. I was wondering, on page 8 of your application, you have a sentence in your third paragraph there that was sort of confusing to me, and it says, calls from a source other than the handset checking or retrieving voicemail messages and incoming calls that leave a voicemail message are free to Nexus end users. Wasn't quite sure what that, how that is different or what that means compared to just a standard voicemail.
I don't actually have my testimony in front of me or the actual exhibit in front of me, but if my memory serves me correct, I believe that sentence has to do with the definition of usage. Danielle, can I defer to you on that?
Yeah, sure. I think what that's saying is that if you call into your the voicemail system to check your voicemail, it counts against your minutes, because Nexus is being charged by its underlying carrier for those airtime minutes.
That's correct. This is Alan Galloway, and I'm looking at that sentence in the application, and it is talking about that those users, if they're calling to check their voicemail from another line, they won't be using up minutes. Or if they're calling to leave a voicemail from another line, they wouldn't be using up minutes. That's what that means.
Oh, okay. I get it.
I apologize if it was inartfully phrased.
I've also heard that there is a database that some of the ETCs are using now that is kind of an interim measure. The provider is CGM. Have you heard of that database?
Yes, so CGM is a vendor to multiple ETCs, and they what they do is these ETCs have outsourced their database to CGM. And so when the whole duplicate issue came to the forefront, CGM said, well, okay, so we administer the databases for these ETCs. We could compare their subscriber bases and eliminate duplicates. But Nexus doesn't outsource that. Nexus has its own proprietary database, and that other than people that have a vendor in common, no one has joined up their databases.
Okay, I heard there was 12 ETCs that are all subscribers to CGM, and just curious whether that was a valid option or not.
Yeah, I am 99.99% sure it's because they all outsource their databases for CGM to administer. And so because they were all on the same platform and there was one company that could compare them, they decided, I think last year, to do that.
And I got a copy of this, what you were talking about earlier, where there is a check on duplicates in various states, and then people are actually getting some kind of a fine or something. And there's a spreadsheet out there that you can get. And it strikes me that I have seen where people have more than one service with the same ETC. And I was just curious how you could have duplicate service with the same company.
So we've been tracking that obviously as well. The FCC has been sending out citations to individuals with more than one Lifeline account, and through the periodic checks that we have in these different states, not just Nexus, but I have other ETC clients. Every once in a while we'll get feedback from USAC that, we found the same subscriber multiple times in your database, although I think with Nexus that's been exceedingly rare. It is due to just a glitch, and you de-enroll the person and, you give the money back. You can file revisions of your 497, and anytime an ETC finds a problem like that, you've got a year to go back and file a revision and give the money back. But like I said, it's not been a problem for Nexus.
I was curious when you said keeping copies of what the customer provided as their proof of eligibility would help eliminate people that are not eligible from trying to participate in the program, and I was wondering why that works.
Why that would work?
Yes.
So just to be clear, under current FCC rules, we're not permitted to keep copies. But if you required the ETCs to keep copies of the food stamp card or the Medicaid card, then if you got audited, and they're going to start doing biennial audits of all these ETCs, then you would have to pony up copies of the proof. Whereas now, if you audit an ETC, the only auditable information that they would have is notes that the representative would take in the customer account. Well, most Lifeline recipients qualify on the basis of food stamps and Medicaid and SSI, but really food stamps and Medicaid is probably 95% of your enrollment. And food stamps is actually probably close to 80-85% is my guess. Well, food stamp cards in the same state all look the same. Let's say in state X, they're all red, okay? And in some states, they don't have the person's name on it. It's just got a number. So what is your representative supposed to note down other than saw red food stamp card and maybe the number? And, sometimes there's not a whole lot of information on there. At least if they had a copy of it, it would be a little that much harder for them to just, fake it if you had an ETC out there who had bad representatives who were willing to break the rules. So I just think it's another, barrier out there for people who are willing to break the rules.
Do you provide incentives for employees for number of signups?
We do not have the payment structure that, in my opinion, causes all the problems, which is disinterested third parties that have signed up, looking upon this as nothing but a commodity. So they're being paid for every enrollment. That's not our model at all. And this is one of the things that we think needs to be eliminated.
Have you had any violations with the FCC?
No, we have not.
And one of the things I read in your filing was that you have good relationships with state commissions. Do you know how you prove that?
I would say that it's probably easier to prove a bad relationship than it is to prove a good one. And there is no evidence of us having any issues with any state commissions. My point was that, you know, we are very, very proactive in terms of providing whatever information any state commission might request. We understand the role. We understand the regulatory scheme. We've designed our systems to be able to facilitate that information, and it's something that we engage in almost all of our states.
Okay, here is my last question, and then someone else can ask questions if there's anything else. I thought in your application it says you're buying services from Verizon, and I thought, is Quest, was Quest formerly Verizon? I mean, in your attachment A, the carriers named are Quest and SRT for the territories you're going to operate in.
If I could jump in, this is Alan Galloway. The list of wire centers in attachment A are the wire center. Those are the ILEC wire centers that cover the territory in which Nexus would be providing service. But the service will actually be provided by reselling Verizon service, Verizon Wireless. So it's just sort of apples and oranges situation. The exchange boundaries are defined by the incumbent carriers just for historical reasons, but the service will be provided by Verizon, not by Quest or SRT.
Okay. Oh, I came up with one more question. Are you related to George Galloway?
The English guy or the... my grandfather was George Galloway, but probably not the one that you're thinking
of. Oh, well, there's one that used to be an attorney for Stoll Reeves.
Yeah, no, I'm not related to him.
Oh, okay. That's it.
All right, thank you, sir. Patrick, do you have any follow-up?
I just have a couple quick questions. I didn't confirm with my records if your list of Quest Corporation exchanges, is that all of the exchanges that Quest serves?
This is Alan again. Yes, I believe that's correct. That was the intent.
And the same for SRT?
Again, yes, that's I believe that's correct.
And there was something in your application that I was curious about. It's on page 6. And it states that if a potential subscriber is requests service that is outside the anticipated network coverage, that Nexus will follow the process specified in 47 CFR 54.202A1I. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I can jump in here. So the process is basically working with Verizon to see if there is something that can't be done from a technical standpoint to extend service, wireless service, to that area, maybe seeing if they have plans to put up an additional antenna or, I don't know that roaming would always be something that Verizon would be willing to go for, but there are certain steps set forth in 202 to, see if there's something that can't be done, and so the idea is we would try to work with Verizon to see if we can we can get that worked out. That being said, we find that most Lifeline subscribers tend to be in more urban areas, and that combined with the fact that Verizon generally has one of the better, if not the best, network coverage capabilities, we really haven't had to deal with that too much.
And if I could add, this is Alan Galloway again, when we looked at this and looked at the Verizon coverage for North Dakota, there's a couple of minor exceptions, but it's basically their map is a sea of red. And so we feel that it's unlikely that situation will actually arise given the service area that we've requested.
That's all I have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Patrick. We've gone past the hour, but I'll give my colleagues a chance to ask one more if they have any follow-ups. But I did have one thing for Mr. Hogue. Would you offer up all of the information as your testimony today?
Yes.
And we would such receive it. So I don't have any additional questions, but I would respect to my colleagues if you have any quick follow-ups before we shut down the work sessions.
Is this questions or comments or both?
Whatever you want.
My comment.
You've got a max of 5 minutes, Commissioner.
My comment, and it'll take far less than 5 minutes, is that sitting here listening to this, I do appreciate listening to the Nexus people talking about wanting to in the tent and car trunk type of marketing. I like the idea, although it doesn't have anything to do with us probably, of requiring a bond with the FCC, of getting authorization to save the eligibility proof. And working with us on providing the information that we would need for us to keep an eye on things within the state and do some auditing, it tells me that the situation is one here where people have seen what they believe is a need and are looking to meet that need in a nice business-like fashion. And I think we have just maybe a very little bit more work to do on some questions and answers that we want to put together. As kind of a format, and we'll get those done, and I do like what I've heard today.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Dorchak?
Okay, I just have one question, and then I'll close, but the food stamp card does not always have a name on it, so if that's the proof of eligibility and you're supposed to match that with a license, how does that do anything to verify that this person is eligible? If that's used 80 to 85% of the time.
It's not in every state. I was raising that as an example in some states. There is the form that requires the person to sign under penalty of perjury that they're getting food stamps. They have to check which program they participate in or if they're qualifying with basis of income. They also have to provide documentation on that, and we won't have the same issue there because we'd actually have to see a level of income. They are certifying under penalty of perjury that they qualify, the basis on which they qualify. The FCC is now sending out individual citations, and I would not be surprised if we started to see some actual law enforcement activity in this area against individuals, it is not a perfect system right now, but Nexus is taking every effort that it can to prevent any waste, fraud, or abuse, and when we get the databases up and running, then it will obviously eliminate most of those issues.
When you get a food stamp, a customer who's using food stamp eligibility as their eligibility for this, and it doesn't have a name but it has a number, do you guys take the next step and verify that number with whatever state agency, our state, Human Services, to make sure that they're eligible, or is it just enough?
Where it's possible for Nexus to consult a state database, it's actually required to under the federal rules. So yes, if that's possible, they do verify that against the state database.
Okay, I'm hoping North Dakota has food stamp cards that have a name on it. Okay, that concludes my questions. Thank you guys very much for your time, for your very thoughtful answers, for the good information. And I'm pleased to hear about all the kind of nationwide reforms that are underway and your confidence in them at addressing the problems with this program. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. The follow-through of we've got a work session next Wednesday on Telluride, and I'm anticipating that after that work session, we may even try to piggyback this work session onto that as well. But I suspect that we'll come to some kind of conclusion this in a couple weeks. Mr. Hoag, it would be your last word. It's your case today. If you have any closing thoughts.
No, I don't, Commissioner.
Okay. With that, we'll go ahead and close the informal on case number PU 13-98. Thank you all very much.